Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics and current events. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
So as Brandon and I were just warming up, we said this might be the week that we just get like 30 minutes into this and look at each other and say, I'm so disgusted. I got nothing else to say. And we're just done.
Yeah, I mean, this was a very dark week in American politics, and it basically brought home everything that's nasty about our politics all at once, and then the reactions have even been more vicious, and that's why it feels off, very
so
off.
Last week was just unforced stupidity by the Democrats.
Right.
This week has a whole different tone to it. This week is one of those weeks where you kind of wake up and you don't maybe recognize, or things that you thought couldn't happen in America in 2018 were front and center. And we're doing this on a Saturday night, coming off the horrible mass shooting in Pittsburgh, where I think now 11 people have been murdered at a synagogue by an anti-Semite who just basically walked in, shouted "All Jews must die," and
right.
started shooting people.
46-year-old anti-Semite who had, again, on social media there were indications that he was going to do something, and once again we're left, you know, saying, well, you know, why was it this reported? Why did nobody act? And time we find ourselves in this place. This week we witnessed, I think, the largest act of domestic political terrorism we've ever seen.
Yeah. So let's start there. 14 devices sent to 12 people. All of them were leadership in the Democratic Party.
Right. Or
two former presidents, Vice President Maxine Waters, John Brennan, basically Trump's hit list for the past 2 years. People that he's gone after in the Democratic Party, a loon job down in Florida,
right.
Made homemade explosive devices. And these weren't fakes.
No.
They actually contained explosive material.
The materials were there. He did not have the intelligence to be able to piece them together correctly so that they would work, thank God.
Yeah.
But the materials were there. These were using materials that are known for explosive devices. It's been confirmed by the FBI that these were serious devices.
This wasn't a hoax.
No.
This wasn't a cry for attention. This was this man trying to kill, to your point, ex-presidents, senators, people that Trump for the past couple of years have basically laid out as his political enemies. And I think it's fair to say that he's framed them as enemies of the people.
Yes, exactly. I mean, people he's gone after directly. And you can't get more direct than this in terms of the correlation between who the president has gone after and who was targeted here.
Robert De Niro,
again, people that the president has gone after directly. So you have political figures, you have celebrities, you have media figures that are all tied up in this. And then if you saw the tweets that this man has put out there too, just, you know, crazy conspiracy theory, very anti-liberal tweets where he's targeted a lot of people. And it's no coincidence one of his tweets targeted Philip Mudd. You may not know Philip Mudd unless you watch CNN. He's a CNN contributor,
okay.
Former CIA official, a CIA agent who's been very critical of the president. So the president has gone after him in his speeches directly. And this guy had tweeted against him as well. And his tweets would typically come right after the president's speeches. And again, you know, average Joe isn't going to know who Phil Mudd is, but neither is some loon like this unless he's listening to the president and then directly parroting and condemning whoever the president is attacking at the time.
So let's take that first issue, is that at the first flyover, this looks like, again, he took the people that the president consistently attacks.
Right.
And when he decided that this was going to be his course of action, he took that exact list, and that's who he sent explosive devices to. So debate that's been going on for the last couple of days is, how much culpability does Trump have in radicalizing this gentleman down in Florida? And again, this depends on what tribe you're in, what news outlet you take. Either you can't draw no inferences,
it does, but see, that's the problem.
Or it's a direct connection.
See, that's the problem, Craig. I think that if you are looking at it as objectively as possible, I mean, the correlation there is just, you know, indisputable.
How can you deny it?
Incontrovertible. Yeah. You can't. I mean, it is irrefutable. The words, the targets, it all lines up. And if you look at the president's rhetoric, I mean, calling his opponents evil, I mean, labeling
them low
IQ. Right.
using references for dogs and animals for these people.
Exactly. The lock her up chant, you know, which continues, which again, if, you know, the president was really sincere about, you know, changing the tone and calming the country down, he would immediately put a stop to that and said, we're not going to do that anymore. You know, cut it out. And that continues at the rallies.
So there's one side of this argument that you can never stop an evil person from doing an evil act. And that when somebody does something like sends pipe bombs through the mail or steps into a synagogue and shoots people, that individually they are the sole person responsible for that because they are the one committing the evil act. And unless somebody specifically told them or threatened them or manipulated them in some way to do that direct thing, you can't attribute it back to a political figure.
Well, and that's true in the legal sense, and it should be. I mean, we should, you know, charge others, you know, based on rhetoric, and we don't do that. But at the same time, you know, extra legal, you know, morally, ethically, we have a responsibility in what we say. And if we're in the public limelight, and if we, especially if we're president of the United States, we have an even greater responsibility in the rhetoric we use. And there's no denying that you have a megaphone as president. I mean, you reach more people than you otherwise would. You know, the president has like over 50 million Twitter followers. His speeches are carried live.
And he's the president and the leader of the free world.
And let's be honest.
Allegedly.
Exactly. And so he is supposed to speak with greater authority, and there's supposed to be greater respect for what he says. And so it's very concerning. You know, if you go back 50, 100 years ago, it might have been a little bit different. The irony is that, you know, our presidents were more measured in what they said than the current president. But back then, we had a fragmented media landscape. We don't have that anymore. We have 24-hour news, social media. So everybody has access to all of this information, and there is always that opportunity for that one lunatic, that one element of the fringe, that one person who's not all there mentally to act based on what he hears and to take things literally, and that's what happens.
So the first concept that we agree on, and I wish that this was getting more debate in the mainstream media or just the media in general, that the president of the United States, his actions, his words carry more weight
than exactly
other people in the conversation.
Yes, and so we have to stop with the whataboutism and comparing him to, you know, Congresswoman Maxine Waters or this person or that person. No, it stops with him. He has an office that is much greater. He has a megaphone. He has a voice that lends itself to authority. You cannot put him on the same level as anybody else.
And you mentioned whataboutism, and I think that's where this argument has completely devolved into.
Right.
So my side of the fence, again, we want to immediately connect these things directly to Trump. And then we want to tie that to the midterms and say, look, folks, if you don't vote as a Democrat, because again, persuading people from side to side, we talked about that last week, that's over. That's not going to happen. We're using this to try to energize sections of our base that are sometimes there, sometimes not there, by holding this up and saying, if we continue and you let this man continue to operate unchecked as president of the United States, this is what the outcome is going to be. And I think your side of the house, and I loosely point to you and your side of the house
right
here, the Republican side of the house that is interested in winning the midterms as a mechanism for emboldening Trump. I think that maybe that's the best way to say it. What they're saying is, hey, you can't, these are individual acts. You can't attribute it to Trump. And then the whataboutism game starts.
Right.
Hey, the guy shot up the congressman baseball field and shot Scalise, and he was a Bernie Sanders.
And that's the one I've heard more and more from my Republican friends.
Yeah.
And again, the reason that doesn't stack up is Bernie Sanders wasn't out there inflaming.
He's not the Democratic president.
He's not the president, but also he wasn't using that type of language that the president uses either. And so it's not even an apples to apples comparison, let alone he's not the president. The other facet to this is each side is motivating the base. Trump gave up on winning anybody but his base a long time ago.
Absolutely.
That's what all these rallies are about. The problem is Trump is unwilling to change his tone or to dial down the rhetoric because his ultimate concern is minimizing losses and keeping his base energized. And so he knows that the rhetoric he uses does that.
So
it accomplishes that, so he's unwilling to change.
Let's put it this way. It's been successful in the past.
Right.
I mean, this is his formula that he won the White House with.
It is.
Why wouldn't he keep coming back to this over and over again?
He only dialed up the rhetoric during the course of the 2016 presidential election. He never dialed it back. And by dialing it up, there was more enthusiasm. He got greater base turnout, and that's how he propelled his
voters.
And
it's on full tilt now as he's making this four times a week, he's doing campaign rallies as he's trying to push that base to get out and vote for the midterms to hold the House.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's done more campaign rallies in his first 2 years than the past three presidents. I mean, it's crazy.
What's been interesting is the whataboutism, how deep it is. And I think this gets to the feeling of grievance on both sides of the House.
Yeah.
Because on the Republican side, I mean, the things that keep coming up is, hey, wait a minute, for 8 years under Obama, you know, we had to put up with liberals, Democrats talking down to us, dictating to us. You villainized every Republican candidate as a racist, a homophobic, you know, from start to finish. Things come out, well, you know, Mitt Romney, the famous Joe Biden line, he's going to put black people back in chains. I mean, once you open up that whataboutism well, and some of that starts to spew out, you realize how deep it goes and how core it is to the conversation.
It is. And, you know, and my side for the longest time would say, you know, that they didn't play identity politics and grievance politics, but they do. And they clearly do that now.
And both we sides do too. Play that. Absolutely.
That's,
we do
that's
too.
Common now on both sides.
And it's just.
And it becomes difficult to rationally and objectively call anything out at that point because the grievance politics takes over. Yeah. And it becomes a comparison almost of looking back and seeing, you know, who did what.
Yeah.
And it becomes a game. And so you don't get anywhere. And so even in what you had this week where you actually had, you know, lives at stake and you had people that were under threat, we end up as a society going back and playing that whataboutism game and grievance politics and arguing, you know, about past incidents. And
it just, it stymies all conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at a point in America now where we've got some really serious things we need to talk about. And it's like, we don't even have the language or the framework even more of how to address each other and how to talk about these things. Because as soon as my side breaks something up, your side's going to break something up. And then I'm going to bring something up. And my side is so full tilt to put the clamps on to Trump. And so full tilt to win the House back and setting up for 2020. Any opportunity we have, we're going to link these things up to the president.
Exactly. And so that's what we're, you know, facing now. And so doesn't seem like there's any common ground. I mean, if there was ever to be any common ground, you would think we would come together when something like this happens and says this has no place in society. This has no place in our body politic, you know, political threats, political assassination attempts. We should be united on this. You know, and it's more telling that we've reached a place where we no longer suspect foreign adversaries of this type of action.
No.
It's our own. It's fellow Americans because of where we are as a country.
So speaking of common ground, as you said that, I started kind of Rolodexing through some thoughts. If we had to find a common ground point that we feel the country, not you and I, but the country could agree on, I'm struggling. Nothing immediately pops to mind. There's nothing that I could say because as soon as the president comes into it, I think that's where everything shatters apart.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, goes to their sides and, you know, puts the blinders on, immediately starts rolling with the talking points anytime the president's directly involved. I mean, if you think back, I mean, we were unified after, you know, 9/11 happened. You know, we have these moments throughout American history that unified the country and where both sides came together and both sides were successful at accomplishing, you know, various legislative achievements. And I don't see that ever happening.
No. We're not
in a place where that could ever happen again.
If there's one thing we know under Trump, no unity is going to happen. Because his whole political strategy is divisiveness. His whole political strategy is grievance. His whole narrative is grievance. And when these things happen, the first thing he pivots to is what party was wronged by it, who won, who lost, and how can I weaponize that politically?
Right.
And you saw it this week. You mentioned the tweet he sent out with, oh, crap, we were doing all great with the election,
yes,
the midterms.
I mean, how astonishing is that?
Here comes a, I'm air quoting, bomb goes off. And it's just like, What in the world?
I mean, he's questioning the validity of this and what, you know, and whether or not this was serious, even as the FBI at the same time is saying, no, this is serious. And in normal times, under any normal circumstances, if a president had tweeted something like that out, we would be saying that's outrageous.
We'd be appalled.
We would be, that's appalling. I mean, how can the president, you know, do that and say, oh, this is interfering with, you know, my, you know, political goals. And, you know, it's taken the conversation away from the momentum the Republicans had. This is so awful because of that. Not because... you know, Americans were, you know, threatened and could have been killed.
Point, the biggest act of homegrown terrorism, that doesn't register at all to him. And comment...
And think about also in the context, I mean, he didn't even make calls to two prior presidents. I mean, they share this unique office. And under any circumstances,
absolutely,
those calls would have been made. And he did do that. I mean, there's so anything that we would consider in terms of protocol or just, you know, being a decent leader and human being, I mean, he did it do.
So a quote like that and a tweet like that, I expect from something like Breitbart News or the Drudge Report or something like that. That's where I expect to find that. When it comes from the president of the United States, and you're right, we don't even, that just whizzes by us anymore. Yeah. We don't even stop and pause to say that's completely inappropriate. And we don't use that as an example. And people have jumped all over that tweet. But if you're defending the actions or if you're trying to play the what about game with the president and the rhetoric with other folks, how do you defend stuff like that?
Yeah. And his defenders should be called on to specifically defend that quote, that tweet. How do they? And so, you know, when Trump took office, you know, the speculation was that he would grow into the office and that he would mature and that, you know, he would become a president who would unify or at least attempt to represent all Americans, even those that didn't vote.
Not even close.
Like, that's clearly not the angle. I mean, we haven't had a moment yet in 2 years where he's attempted to do that. And it speaks to the irony of the situation. I was talking with a friend of mine, fellow moderate Republican, who's having this political crisis.
You two have to feel like, I mean, you guys got to like meet like once a month, have a drink, and say, you know, you got to bond up with those few people that are left to try to get through this next 2 years, I would think.
I do. He's moved out to California, but we're going to get together in a month or so. But so we were talking about this in the context that happened. And I made the comment, you know, that the last 2 years, I mistakenly said, instead of saying the last 2 years, I said the last 4 years have seemed like 10 years.
Yeah.
And he had to correct me. He's like, you mean 2 years? I'm like, well, it feels like four, which
it's
feels like
years.
10. Like, how many years is it?
Just the exhaustion factor of this
whole
thing.
I mean, just constant. It's...
So there's some members of the media that really have, I think, kind of made an ass of themselves this week. And the one I'm going to put right at the top of the list is Hugh Hewitt. And Hugh Hewitt has been a conservative pundit and speaker and thinker for decades. He was on MSNBC for a while. He had a show on MSNBC.
Right.
And I've always at least found him to make some rational arguments and points.
Yeah, he never seemed to be a bomb thrower like Limbaugh or Hannity or
but
some of those
once
others.
Again, he seems to have gone all in on Trump.
Right.
And basically, he got into an argument with somebody that said, the basic of the argument was, sending a bomb is equivalent to Mitch McConnell getting yelled at in a restaurant. And that was his equivalency of putting those two actions on the same plane. And he was playing the what about game, and he was so intent in proving his point that the Democrats are as to blame to this as Trump that he made that kind of asinine connection, and he wouldn't back off it one inch. Not one inch. That's what's really been interesting to watch is people on both sides. If you feel Trump is 100% to blame for the bomber, you will listen to no other argument. And if you feel that, hey, this is Trump is just the latest extension of this phenomenon and the Democrats have certainly contributed to it, you're not listening to anybody else that does not support that
right.
argument. And even if the argument gets ridiculous on either side, you'll run right into ridiculous. Because
that's what I don't
you just
understand.
Can't back up.
Otherwise, intelligent people on both sides who are falling prey to this. And so you wonder, do they actually believe this? Or they have to be, you know, more intelligent than that to believe that. Or if this is just, you know, it's a game. They're falling in line. They're parroting the talking points. They're, you know, they have audiences, especially with some of these. You know, again, I hate to be cynical, but, you know, the name of the game, and I like to remind people, particularly with some of these pundits that have either, you know, online media or, you know, radio shows.
Absolutely.
They have audiences they have to maintain. Yeah.
Clickbait. Absolutely.
And so at the end of the day, it's not about what they actually believe. And in some cases, I don't think they actually believe half of what they throw out there.
I can't see how they do.
It's about maintaining an audience and maintaining the revenue that comes in from that. And it's a career for them. I mean, it's a job.
I'm so tired of the three-person panel approach to everything. Or you get like...
It's overdone.
The super panel. Where right. Like it looks like the Brady Bunch theme where there's like nine
six
people.
Six or nine people. And then they're all talking over each other. Like, and then you're just like, stop.
What are
this
we
is the
doing?
Problem.
And it just, some of that does feel staged. Some of that does feel that you can't get three people on a panel at one of the cable things and say, okay, I'm playing this role, you're playing this role, you're right. playing this role. We got 90 seconds. Let's make some, let's make something that somebody would want to look.
Cause what do you,
cause we're
going to
retweet
that?
This. We're yeah. going to, what, other than what you just brought up, hey, I've got my other media channels that I'm supporting and growing. I'm going to come off as Brandon and I are going to have a confrontation on this. So now you've got something to tweet and post. I've got something to tweet and post. And it just seems to kind of go on in that
and
cycle.
I do think that is part of the problem. I think people like, you and I would be less prone to receiving invitations to being on those types of panels because they're looking for polar opposites, like diametrically opposed people, because they want the conflict because they think it'll drive ratings. And so, and it just perpetuates this notion that it's black and white and you can't come to agreement because that's
absolutely
not what they're looking for.
I could never be on one of those panels because one, I don't think fast enough. So
right.
I would have
it's
to have
rapid
something
response,
written
yeah.
down and prepared. That's all I could do. And I think that's the strength of podcasting and why podcasting is so popular.
Right.
Take as much time as you want and talk an issue out. I mean, just don't take 90 seconds where, yeah. again, we're trying to put something that my real goal of appearing on this panel is to get myself reposted. If we want to take one topic and talk about one thing for an hour, let's
do that.
We can do that.
Because many of these topics, there's too much nuance. I mean, you cannot in, yeah. you know, a minute or 5 minutes or in sound bites be able to understand, you know, all angles of the issue. And that's what cable news does. I am a fan of Kirsten Powers, who's a moderate Dem.
Yeah.
Because I feel like when she's on those panels.
She has pounded Trump this week.
She has. Yeah, she's been. But, you know, she is one of those who tries to see both sides and kind of yeah. approaches it from that mindset. And it's interesting because she does not have that rapid response all the time. You can tell she on some of the panels, she actually has to stop and think about what she's going to say, and which I actually appreciate because yeah. so many people speak on those panels without thinking. They're
and
just
Mike blah, 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 went through this during the rapid. Campaign. He's like, all you can do at a candidate meet and greet is spit out
yeah.
your prepared stuff. And you can never, it's totally unacceptable to say, that's a great point. I haven't really put a lot of thought into that. Let me think about that and get back to you. That's like a total fail.
Which
and that's
I
why
don't
you
understand.
Just keep regurgitating again, the same shit over and over and over.
Right.
And that's what I feel this, that the bomber story, until the bomber comes out and we learn more about him and until we get some, maybe some personal information or he talks about, you know, his relationship or how he feels about Trump or that's the next wave of this story that's coming.
Oh yeah. This is just the beginning. Yeah. I mean, they're going to have to dig into his whole history yeah. and his writings and what he said.
How about that white van he was driving around in?
Oh my God. Talk about crazy. Did you see when they were talking to his employer? He talked about how...
I saw something and I almost clicked on it and I'm like, I can't do it.
Well, she was on...
it was a pizza. He was a pizza delivery
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, and she was basically talking about how he was very racist. He was very yeah. anti-woman, very misogynistic.
He was American Indian too, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
And he was also, he worked at a strip club, the same strip club that Stormy Daniels was at earlier this year, apparently.
So somebody said he was a stripper.
No.
He just worked at a strip club.
He worked at a strip club. I think he was a guard or
okay,
something.
That makes sense.
Yeah, he was not.
Somebody said he was a performer, and I'm like, wow, that's a... That doesn't speak well to the adult entertainment industry in the state of Florida at that point.
Right. But I do think it's weird. I'm like, here, you know, the connection, it's like same strip club as Stormy Daniels. It's like all these pieces like intersecting. But yeah, so you have this individual who, by every account, like history of mental problems, history of...
been arrested like 12 times or something.
Run-ins with the law. And, yeah. And someone who attended a Trump rally, you know, who was motivated by Trump's words. And many of us have said this all along, right? That it takes one crazy person. That's why the responsibility with what you say matters so much, because, you know, these people are out there and we saw it happen. And I hate to say it, but I feel like this was only a matter of time, right?
Yeah, I feel
like we all kind of saw this coming. It was going to
happen.
The
more you turn the heat up, you can't keep turning the heat up and then
not expect consequences.
Be surprised when something explodes.
Right.
And once again, Trump had a moment as the United States president to accept some responsibility, to talk about his role maybe in some of this.
Oh, and he not only did not do that, but who did he put the blame on? Specifically, the media.
The media.
He turned it right
back
onto the media.
Right back to his thing.
Oh. So, which is interesting since the media was targeted, specifically CNN, and here he is almost basically blaming the victim for what happened.
Didn't call off his rally.
Nope.
Played the same old shtick he always plays.
Which,
CNN
again,
sucks.
Normal times,
lock her up.
It is astonishing that the president would not cancel a political rally in light of what happened.
He didn't cancel his rally today.
No, I know. I don't understand it. Yeah.
So let's talk about a group of, I'm going to call them kind of to the right pundits, your Ann Coulters. They came out immediately
the
and started talking
flag.
About Rush Limbaugh. This is a false flag. This was done by Democrats.
Which,
this
by
is to
the
throw
way,
you off the scent.
Kudos to the Weekly Standard, which is a conservative publication, but mainstream conservative. So they had a great article out about what they call the rise of the false flag conservatives.
Yeah.
Ann Coulter, these others, and how detrimental this is to politics in America, and why, you know, they need to be disavowed and disowned immediately. But yeah, I mean, it was almost immediately. It was immediately. And again, just saying that this is a Democratic conspiracy, that this is probably, you know, Democrat operatives that are doing this to be able to, you know, increase their... it was disgusting and just abhorrent that that's
Trump's
what
tweet
immediately went to.
Almost supported that.
Well, yeah.
He backed that up with that obnoxious,
bomb in
ridiculous
quotations.
Tweet he sent out. I think we're at the point where we just assume the worst in each other in every single scenario.
Yeah.
Okay, 14 members of Democratic leadership, ex-presidents and donors got sent pipe bombs. We immediately fall to, well, what's the thing that would be most advantageous for my side and make you look the worst? You did it to yourself. And there's a group of people who will run to that worst possible place on each other, that you guys have them, we have them. And that just seems to be what that's becoming more and more. The first wave of this story is the ridiculous conspiracy or the false flag, which tries to set a narrative before any facts come into the equation, and ruins in some ways or attempts to ruin the conversation from that point forward.
Well, it completely distracts the conversation, and you have a whole segment of society that will latch onto that and buy it hook, line, and sinker because it conforms to the worldview they have.
No.
And they don't want to accept the uncomfortable Absolutely. Truth that, you know, there could be other people, crazy people there identified with my ideology, with my president. We're not going to entertain that at all. We're just going to entertain it's a Democratic conspiracy.
So for the last year, and I was thinking about this on the ride over here tonight, this is a rare Saturday night podcast because once again, work interfered with Brandon this week and we had to push our podcasting time back. So we made a pitch for that sponsor last time. So we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But on the drive over here, for the last year, I think I've tried to expand my bubble, get out of my bubble, listen to people from the other side, and try to really hear how did this happen and why are we where we are right now. And the other side, the conservative side, the Trump's base, the folks from the Midwest, uneducated white Americans who elected Trump, I think, yes, they have some things that they legitimately should be mad about and should be concerned about. Republicans have things that they can legitimately point to Democrats and say, we made a turn when you guys did this. You know, some stuff happened under Obama, the treatment of Mitt Romney, calling G-Dub a war criminal. I mean, there's those things are all completely legitimate.
Oh, well, completely. And the problem is when it's used as an excuse to take things to the next level, to ramp up the rhetoric, incitement.
And if you didn't vote for Hillary, there's part of me in my side that say, listen, if you're a Dem and you didn't vote for Hillary, hey, you just had to suck it up and do it.
Right.
What did Ann Coulter say that one year? Just hold your nose and vote for John McCain.
Yeah.
Hey, because again, what was on the other side of the fence was so unknown and had such a high risk factor, you had to go here. If you're an independent or Republican, totally understand why you didn't vote for Hillary. Lots of people said, I just couldn't pull the lever. I get that. With all of that said, haven't we crossed the point, though, where enough is enough? Haven't people seen enough? I mean, when do we call this, okay, this has gone horribly wrong. The person who occupies the presidency right now does not reflect what we want to be as a nation, as a people, or what we expect as a president.
Right.
It feels like, I mean, what else is it going to take to push people over that barrier?
I don't know. I feel like we've approached this several times and we've said, you know, maybe this is it now. Maybe this is, you know, the turning point. And I feel like it never is. Like we keep, you know, hitting these horrific milestones in terms of, you know, what American norms and violating those. And yet
Trump's never paid a price.
There's no political price
any
paid.
Of that. We talked before we got on mic. If the Dems don't take the House, you can expect a first class hissy fit meltdown on our side.
I mean,
it's going to be, and again, what you said, you just feel like each week, what's worse going to happen? It feels like we're stepping towards something bad happening. If we don't take the House, I'm not sure what the next act of this is going to be. Because now Trump is emboldened. I fully expect him to fire Sessions. I expect him to fire Mueller. And then we're kind of all off into this weird constitutionally crisis place that I don't think any of us want to go.
Yeah, and if we're in that place too, I mean, you know, Trump, his one saving grace has been, you know, the economy, but expect the markets to tank.
There's going to be a slowdown. There's going to be a correction. Yeah.
And I mean, and granted, you know, he's going to face that likely before the end of his first term anyway, which is cyclical.
Just a cycle.
Yeah. But especially if we're in a constitutional crisis, that's going to rattle the markets completely.
Yeah. We had another mass shooting today.
Yes, synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yeah. I believe 11 people killed is what it's up to. Yeah.
11 people have died.
46-year-old white anti-Semite extremist.
And one thing that's weird about this guy is no history so far they've been able to cover. He was totally unknown to law enforcement. No record.
Okay, I hadn't heard that yet.
Nothing like that. So there was nothing that said somebody should have pointed at this guy and say, listen, this guy is thinking of this. Somebody ought to get in front of him. So this is that kind of, by all indications, he acted alone from what they're thinking now. This is that lone wolf who's not on anybody's radar, who something happens and suddenly, and he sent some tweet or something that said, I'm going in, was the last
he did.
Line.
I did hear that he had a couple of ramblings online where he complained.
Some site called Gab?
Yeah, which I've never heard of.
I've never heard of that.
And apparently they're cooperative FBI and they took his content down.
Yeah.
They had content on there, but apparently he has been upset with Jewish organizations that have aided refugees in the country because he's very anti-refugee.
And he was anti-caravan. There were some things he talked about that. When you try to convince people that we're being invaded by an infestation of people, and I just air quoted infestation because I believe Mr. Trump, our president, has used that word before.
I know he's used the word invasion.
Yeah, I'll say invasion.
Yeah.
Where there's an invasion of people that are coming here who don't belong. They're taking economic opportunity from you. And what Trump has made very clear in the last couple of months,
they're
destroying our culture. Again, you have to expect that if somebody is on the fringe and you pound this day after day after day, things like this are going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why Trump is most upset with the pipe bomb domestic terrorism, because it takes the focus off the caravan, which he's been hitting day in, day out.
So what do you think about, the more I'm learning about the caravan, this is mostly women and children. They're 1,000-ish miles from the border.
Right.
They don't expect them even to make it to the border.
It won't happen. When I first heard about it and saw it, I felt like, you know, actually this is a gift to the Republicans.
Because absolutely.
If you look at the optics of it,
yeah.
It's this long, massive
line of people stretching. You can frame this in stretching. A way that it looks very menacing.
And it does. It feels like there's this whole just, innumerable group of people headed towards our border. And we don't know who they are, what they're all about, and they're going to come right in. And it reminded me of somewhat of the refugee crisis in Europe. You know, and European leaders paid a political price for that, particularly with just the flow, you know, when that happened.
Hundreds of thousands.
That was, very different. But
and
again,
they were all from the Middle East.
And they were all from the Middle East too, which is different. But the optics of this, I thought, could have come at a worse time. But again, you know, several of them have already been turned back. Mexico has also taken a hard line on, you know, not letting them go forward. So this is really, I think, going to be a non-issue.
I think so, too. Trump is trying really, really hard. We rolled 1,000 troops down there. I think he said they were going to roll 1,000 more. Are we going to have an armed confrontation with a caravan of mostly women and children, refugees, people seeking asylum? And just, by the way, for everybody
listening, people
don't
understand the difference between illegal immigration and asylum, which is asylum is a political maneuver, and
which
it's
these people have every right
it's
to
legal.
Apply for. Oh, and by the way, you have to be on U.S. soil to apply for asylum.
Exactly.
So this idea that this is some lawless group of renegades who are just trying to ram through, I don't think that really plays out.
No, that doesn't fit. Nor does the narrative, again, with the false flag people on the right who are saying that, you know, the Democrats organized this, they set it all up as if... I'm sorry, Huey, I don't know how your party could be that effective at organizing something like this when
we
guys aren't effective at doing anything else.
We can't pick a leader. We can't pick a message.
Right.
But we're going to get 7,000 people from Honduras to the United States border on, November 4th? And we're going to time it. It's ridiculous.
It's laughable. And then even if you... Even if that were somehow remotely possible, how does that help you guys?
It doesn't.
Politically, that does not help you guys.
It's
nuts.
The whole thing is ridiculous. So Trump, as he's gotten into midterm campaign mode, this week was just, I guess this week was like a child telling you untruths.
Oh, yeah.
From the president. One of them was that there were Middle Easterners in the middle of this caravan, and they were using this as an excuse to sneak into our country.
Right.
Jim Acosta from CNN?
Who pressed him on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't like Acosta. Acosta's kind of a douche anyway, but he did press him on it. And I'm paraphrasing here, but his quote was, well, there's no proof. There's no proof of anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but you don't know if it's true either.
What kind of rationale is that?
Okay.
There's no proof of anything.
I don't know what that is.
We're going to throw it out there and say it anyway.
Well, and then other Trump lies. Apparently, there's riots in California over them being a sanctuary city. there are multiple cities in California in flames because of their immigration stance. I don't think that's really true. And we're two people in the middle income tax bracket.
Right.
Apparently, before the election on the 6th, Trump is going to pass a multi-billion-dollar tax cut for the middle class.
Yeah, it's just going to happen.
Congress isn't in session. So I think
Executive order, I guess.
Pressed on that, I think what he said was they would sign some sort of memorandum that they wanted to do this, and then Congress would vote on it when they got back.
Like the memorandum with North Korea, that worked out very well.
So he's
all about optics.
He's not even trying anymore.
No.
To... The first rule of spin is the spin at least must be somewhat believable. He's not even going down
there. No, he's just throwing anything out there.
Absolutely.
Stick
I'm desperate to
base.
Keep the House. I feel pretty good about the Senate, but I want to pick up some stuff that allows me to do more without having to worry about a few Senate votes. There is no line that the president will not cross to try to spin a narrative to put fear in his base to get them to vote.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Where is Ronald Reagan? Where is the first Bush? Where are the elder statesmen of the Republican Party who stood up with grace and authority and who had a history and a body of work behind them that they were believable and they had been here before and they projected that leadership about them? Where Who?
They are no more. We don't have them left. I keep scratching my head saying, who's going to step up? There's nobody.
And then the underlings are McConnell and Ryan and Lindsey Graham. They've just totally sold out any soul that the Republican Party had at some point.
They have fallen in line like good foot soldiers, you know, behind the president, and there isn't anybody. And then, you know, the couple of somewhat quasi-independent voices are leaving the Senate. Retiring. They're you know, don't want
to. Send hell with it. I get pounded by my Democratic friends all the time when I say conservative principles are valid and need to be debated in the United States. The size and the scope of the government is something that every day we need to be actively debating. Is this something the government
absolutely
should do? Is there
it's
a better
healthy
way?
Because, I mean, if we don't have that debate and, you know, the size and scope grows and the spending grows unchecked, I mean, long term, that's not good. I mean, the best policy you have is through compromise. When Reagan was president and Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, the compromise, which, again, that seems like generations removed from where we are today. That could never happen.
That was like medieval times.
Yes. Yeah.
But I hear all the time, conservatives outdated, there's no need for those principles anymore. The reason we don't like Republicans is because we've outgrown what conservatism is. And I always push back at that. Some core principles of conservatism are really important.
They are,
and they really need to be preserved and debated and implemented where
and they deserve
they make
a place.
Sense. And they're as relevant. The core to conservatism is as relevant today as the core of liberalism.
And exactly, and I think it always will be. And I think those two philosophies are always going to have value. The challenge is separating out core conservatism from what we're seeing from the White House today, because I don't believe that's core conservatism. If you look at fiscal restraint, responsible foreign policy, standing up to aggression, free trade.
Yes.
I mean, Trump has basically set fire to all of those.
He's just burned all of that to the ground. So when I say that to a Democrat friend of mine, they accuse me of not being progressive enough. If all liberals and Democrats were like you,
that makes me cringe.
We would have never made any progress in gay rights. You know, all of these things that we've been able, health care, those would all fall by the wayside because you couldn't be progressive enough to push those things forward.
But see, and that's a misnomer because if you look at, I mean, who was the key justice on the gay rights decisions on the Supreme Court?
The dude that just retired, right? Kennedy.
Yeah. Yeah. And he made a conservative case in terms of freedom, you know, individual freedom and, you know, conservatives are all about individual rights and freedom for that, as have others. And even if you look in the House and the Senate on major legislation like gay rights, there's been a handful of moderate Republicans that have always swung that way. So again, it's a mistake if you look at those solely from a political lens, because there are issues that I think can transcend that divide. And, you know, again, any philosophy or any ideology is softened by opposition and being able to look inside and see what's good or bad or what needs to be tweaked. If you don't have that, if you have no check on, it's just not healthy.
And every time I seem to say that to a Republican, we immediately go to, well, you're pro-choice, you're not pro-life, and you're using these things to promote an agenda around gay rights, transgender, and other issues, you know, social issues that I don't agree in. And we never find a point to even start by just saying, let's take those things you just said, strong defense, free trade, personal liberty.
Yeah.
Let's just start there. We can all
agree on those.
How do we push that forward? So horrific thing at Pittsburgh. Again, if you've anybody
week overall too major.
If anybody's listened to this podcast, I'm as cynical about gun control and shooting as I've ever been. I just don't see. We're not going to have another. There's no tolerance even talk about this.
Well, not with
from
the leadership
a gun control
we
perspective.
Have. We don't have the leadership there. We can't have that conversation.
This is all going to be spun out to what are the winners and losers politically for these two horrible events that happened this week, and to talk about once again, this was an AR-15 style shooting. How did he get the gun? Was it legal? What a background check. I've just given up on that we can have an adult-based conversation about any of that stuff.
Right. We're going to replay the same conversation we replay whenever, you know, a mass shooting happens and then nothing results from it.
I don't even think we're going to get that far.
Probably not.
This is all going to be, I think, just political, and I don't even think we're going to give lip service to even some of the things that we mildly talk about for a 24-hour news cycle, and then it all just kind of fades away.
And that's kind of shocking that we're at that point. I mean, if you go back, yeah, you know, years ago, we would have spent, you know, weeks, if not months, you know, on an issue like this or on an event, and said, so we just move on to the next thing. Yeah. I mean, it loses significance.
Especially gun control. Yeah. I think my side has become so entrenched in asking for things that will never happen. It's kind of what's the point?
And yet you go back to the majority of polling out there that shows, you know, 85-90% of Americans agree
it's a winner across the board.
Background checks on, yep, regulations on age for, yep, you know, assault weapons, you know, things like that that transcend the divide. And but you're right. I mean,
we're not even going to try. Yeah. We're not even going to get there. Megyn Kelly this week. I thought that was really interesting what happened to her. And I think she's been officially thrown off her show.
She has, yeah. So the show is ended.
She's going to get fired,
yeah,
too.
So there's no more episodes of the show. They're negotiating her contract, you know, and she, which will be interesting because she was making, how much was it, $23 million?
$23 million a year on a $69 million total deal.
Yeah.
So I've always wanted to, one, be, I wish I was a child actor so I could have done something from age like 6 to 13 and it like goes into syndication and I never have to work as an adult again.
And then you just like live off of those residuals.
I go make some weird appearances where I still like act like I'm 12 or something.
That would be the life.
That would be awesome. I want to avoid the drug addiction and stuff that a lot of those people go through. Yeah. But that would be awesome. And I set this up for, and I'll throw you in the same boat with me. If you had a $69 million contract, I would make sure that I met with somebody or I went to some training, some coaching or something to say, I get it. It's 2018. Everybody's hypersensitive about everything. We're not going to debate if that's real or not, but help me understand areas that puts my $69 million in jeopardy, because I'm going to try to avoid.
Because you wouldn't take that risk. And help me understand, how did she not? I mean, when you have a show like that, don't you meet beforehand with the producers and go over the topics and all that and get feedback? And you're telling me either nobody told her.
Hey Brandon, you're going to talk about costumes today, and people may bring up things like culture appropriation, all that. We've got a couple lines for you. We just want you to avoid it all altogether. And if you get stuck in a spot where you're uncomfortable, throw to me to commercial, and we're done. Yeah. Didn't that conversation happen?
I don't know how that did come up, no.
So part of this is just the whole lunacy and dumb-dumbness of Megyn Kelly.
Which I've always liked Megyn Kelly. I felt like she's always been a straight shooter. I think that, you know, when it's come to like investigative pieces, she's been able to do well. But ever since she made the move to primetime, leaving Fox, I mean, she has just completely floundered. I mean, it's just, it hasn't been good.
Well, I have a different view of Megyn Kelly. So Megyn Kelly has been peddling soft racial stuff for many, many years on Fox. But she was in a very comfortable place that's very comfortable with those stories. So, and we go back to her famous, "Don't worry, kids, Santa Claus is white."
Yeah, there was that. Yeah.
She has a history of making these types of, I'm going to call them ignorant and insensitive comments. I don't think Megyn Kelly is a racist. I just think as a 46-year-old pretty white woman, she just really, who worked at Fox most of her career, just didn't have to worry about it that much. Just didn't really have to educate herself. If you think blackface in any way is appropriate, you're just ignorant on the topic and the history of blackface.
Right. And what that has been used for going back. Yeah. And our, you know, history with race as a country.
And if you're going to talk about blackface on a TV show on NBC, you might want to spend 15 minutes looking into it prior to running that talk track out there.
Yeah.
Which she obviously
that did not happen.
Didn't do.
And understand your audience, because when you're on daytime like that, her audience is much more diverse than when she was at Fox.
This isn't your hardcore Fox crowd.
Right. So you would think that her tone, her you know, personality, types of things she would talk about would change, and that did topically, but she never made that change completely. And so I don't understand, you know, her thought process and not factoring in the audience changing.
She was likable on, she was one of the more likable members of the Fox opinion team.
Right.
But to what you just said, that doesn't translate to a broader base.
No,
audience.
It doesn't. I mean, when she was on Fox, I think one thing that kind of endeared her, and I think that like executives over, because this was ABC she's been on, right?
NBC.
NBC, right. Yeah. NBC executives probably thought that she could be mainstream because she didn't have that heavy partisan bent like so many of the other ones on Fox did. So she was kind of just more down the line as far as that went. But as we've seen, she has other baggage.
Well,
that
she
brings with her.
She became more of a sympathetic character when Trump went after her in a grotesque way at that debate.
Yeah.
She was also she was sexually harassed by Roger Ailes.
And she spoke up about
that. And I think NBC made a calculation that, hey, we can package her and present her in a different way that's more appealing to the audience. And in the end, it figured out, I think what happened is Megyn Kelly's just Megyn Kelly.
Yeah. And she had a number of other on-air incidents, too. With
the Alex Jones. Remember that mag?
Oh, there was that.
She interviewed Alex Jones. That was awful.
That was pretty bad. There was she was meeting with, I can't remember her name, the cast member from Will and Grace.
Yeah, it's
as well.
Did being on the show turn you gay or something?
Yeah.
She asked Jane Fonda when her last plastic surgery was.
That happened too.
And Jane Fonda stopped and like, what? What are you talking about? This is a conversation I have with my son all the time. That for people in the short run, they can modify who they are to take advantage of a situation or try to gain something in the short term.
Right.
But on a longer arc, we are who we are.
And that'll come out.
And it always comes out. And I think that just, Megyn Kelly proved this again. They tried to package her in a way and make her kind of in the short term more viable to this audience. But over time, Megyn Kelly's Megyn Kelly.
Yeah.
And I think Megyn Kelly is insensitive to and doesn't know a lot about any experience other than being a 46-year-old pretty white woman. And I think that's just what happened.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's kind of how this, and I think from, you know, the beginning the rollout was very flawed, and so her show never took off.
Sucks. If you've ever tried to watch it,
I've seen pieces of it, bits and pieces.
So, one, who watches that show? Because aren't most of its core audience, let's talk about Today and Good Morning America or all of those, mm-hmm. aren't people at work while those shows are on?
It's daytime, so yeah. Stay-at-home moms.
I don't understand network television at all anymore. The idea that I would have to be in front of my TV at a certain time to do something, that's ridiculous.
Well, and most of us don't live like that anymore. I mean, we have streaming options.
If you can't stream it or I get it exactly what I want it, I'm not watching any of that.
And occasionally, like if there's some kind of controversy associated with one of the daytime shows, like I will go and find it on YouTube or find the clip and watch it later.
Or if something good happens, I'm going to watch a 5-minute clip, but I'm not going to watch an hour
show,
of Megyn Kelly doing something. So Brandon has picked up his notebook because we talked about, like, Tuesday, I started getting a little nervous. Like, you know, we've had this really good run of topics, not good run of it being good news, but there's been a lot to talk about and a lot's bubbled to the surface. We start hitting like Tuesday, Wednesday, and I'm like, shit, what are we going to talk about? And then, of course, the world blows up and we go from there. But you actually had some interesting and important topics that we should be talking about right now that just got totally sucked out
of
this week's cycle.
So I did. So one of those was the announcement by the president that as a country, we're withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So that was the treaty signed between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev.
Going back to Gorby on this one.
To limit nuclear weapon proliferation among all of the world's leading powers. And so that treaty has served us well. It led to the end of the Cold War, the denuclearization of Europe. And so Trump announces that because Russia isn't abiding by the dictates of that treaty, that the United States is just going to withdraw, which makes no sense on any level and is going to cause just incredible disruption. It sends a message that instead of enforcing the treaty, instead of, you know, levying pressure on Russia, we're just going to give up on it. So have at it, Russia. You know, go develop whatever you want. And as far as any other country, guess what? It's free range now.
Don't we have something like 64,000 nuclear warheads in our arsenal?
We
some
do,
ridiculous number like that.
And the president's claim that somehow this treaty restrained us or constrained us from is just ridiculous and based on what we have.
Wasn't this one thing that Rex Tillerson said? They put him in a room and they showed him our arsenal of nuclear weapons, and he kept saying, "I want that bigger. I want more. I want more." This has been something he's. Right. I have a feeling this was just kind of an excited utterance he made. He put
like a five-year-old boy.
Yeah, he saw something. You know, he saw. I don't
the
think
crazy
there's much
thing
to
is,
this.
You know, in one announcement, I mean, he's basically unraveling Reagan's nuclear disarmament legacy, which should cause concern among conservatives who admire Reagan.
Should have gone crazy.
Because, again, that brought the end of the Cold War and led to, peace, basically. And so, but that doesn't matter. We just shrug and move on.
Good thing we've got an experienced, cool customer like John Bolton whispering in his ear, who doesn't want to just bomb and invade everybody to help him through this.
And that was the most dangerous foreign policy pick that he could have done. And
I'm still shocked we haven't invaded Iran yet. I mean, he's openly said that for like 30 years. So
yeah, I'm sure it's coming. The other thing I wanted to highlight was,
it'll tweet Iran next week. I would be so mad at you.
It'll be a notification of my tweet.
Yeah. Hey guys, this is what we landed some troops in Iran. No big deal.
The other thing I wanted to hit on was Trump at one of his rallies embracing the term nationalist and saying he's going to wear it proudly and he's happy to be a nationalist. So he either A, clearly doesn't understand the historic undertones of what nationalism is. But then he also seemed to, you know, at least play ignorant when a reporter asked him about white nationalists, saying he had never heard of that term before.
No, what? Which, I've never seen those two words put together.
Come on. And again, for him, again, for the leader of the free world to embrace the term nationalist with all of the context throughout the world with the nationalist movements, for those that don't understand what that signifies, you know, far-reaching power into the state, this almost a super unhealthy infatuation with one's own national identity, anti-minority, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, populist economic policy, isolation in terms of foreign policy. And nationalism is typically what has caused the great world wars. Nationalism led to World War I, resulting in World War II.
Nationalism is a precursor to things like fascism.
Right.
I mean, it's the first step to, you
it
pointed
is the
out,
first step,
that
yeah.
really bad things happen.
Nationalism was the precursor to the Nazi Party in Germany and National Socialism.
You can't get to being the Nazis unless you first take a tour through nationalizing your thought process, your political process, and your society.
And I wish I could remember the quote. Charles de Gaulle had a really great quote about nationalism versus patriotism and how they're different, because they are very different. You can be patriotic and love your country, but if you're a nationalist, that takes it on a whole different level of political context. That's something that under any normal circumstance, someone would have advised the president or chided him or say, you have to retract this.
Take a highlighter and just X that word out.
We've never had a president who's subscribed and said, I'm going to be proud of being a nationalist.
So I'll try to defend Trump slightly here, and I'm reaching for this one. So he framed it as nationalist versus globalist. So maybe what he was saying, and again, maybe, I don't think he knows any of the history that you just laid out of nationalists and what that means and what can be implied by that word.
Right.
I think he was just searching for a word that in his mind is on the opposite side of globalist bad, this one good. And I think that was just the word he landed on.
Yeah, and I think you should have used the term America first, which is typically
absolutely.
The term he
goes for. Could have wordsmithed that 1,000 different ways.
And again, this goes back to the problem when you have a president who has no understanding of history, that doesn't understand history, context, anything, and you get these types of verbal faux pas.
Well, he was off monitor too, I think, at that point during that rally. I can't imagine that in the prepared remarks that scroll across the monitor, the word nationalist was in there.
I can't believe that would have, speechwriter would have been saying, no, that's not going
to
happen.
Somebody would have made a call to somebody and said, I could see John Kelly just on the phone saying, delete that word right now. Turn his prompter off. Do something. But we're not, if he wants to do it on his own, we can't stop him. But there's no way that was a prepared written thing. He just
it was off the cuff impromptu. Yeah. It had to be.
I'm not a globalist. When am I? And to your point, this is a stopping point to talk about America first and your policy and blah. Instead, he just I'm embracing this nationalist thing. And again, everybody there just hoots and hollers and great and claps and okay. I mean, if a Democratic candidate did that, we would have a meltdown.
Oh, we would, yeah.
So,
my side would be apoleptic.
I'm trying
reaction
not to just lob
crazy
things over at Trump's base and at the Republican Party, but I'm sorry. We hold our candidates to a higher academic and intellectual standard than the Republicans are at this point in time.
I would qualify that, I say, in this point of time. I think that would it have been the case prior to this, I would say we had held our candidates to a higher standard.
That's been debatable up to this point, but right now,
I would have to agree with you. Right now, we do not.
What about those clips we saw since you were in Florida? DeSantis, and is it Andrew McCullough?
Gillum. Andrew Gillum.
How about I just saw some of the 30-second tweet cut-ups where he's hitting him on racism and stuff. He looks like he's just eviscerating that guy. That guy looks like he is in physical pain when he said, listen, I don't think you're a racist. Racists think you're a racist. Kind of a good tagline, but I mean, he is really going at that guy.
He is, and the problem is DeSantis has given him a lot to work with. His campaign has had a lot of missteps. He hasn't been able to respond coherently when he's been criticized. And so I think the latest polls, and having just been in Florida, like, this race is dominating the airwaves. Yeah. I mean, it's everywhere you go. This governor's race. And Gillum, I think the latest polls still have him up by a couple points.
Yeah, but it's anybody's race.
Yeah, it's
at
a dead
point.
Heat. It's Florida.
We are 10 days out from the midterms.
Oh,
man. If something says, just get this over
with.
Can
we make it happen tomorrow? Like, let's
speed some ways up. I'm excited. In some ways, I'm terrified. Because, again, I'm going to sit on my couch on the 6th. I got no idea what to expect.
Right.
I don't know what's coming. And it may be one of those nights we have to stay up to 2 or 3 in the morning to digest what actually is happening. So
I think some of these races are going to be very close and maybe too close to call. So we may be in store for some recounts as well.
I think the Dems win the House. They don't win it by – they win by 5 to 10 seats. And I think we lose a seat or two in the Senate. That would be my guess. But if we win the House, we effectively end the policy side of Trump's presidency.
You do. I still think they could possibly win by 10 to 15 seats. So I'm giving them that possible margin. But Senate is out of reach. That's
not
going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
But, you know, really all they need is one House of Congress, part of Congress to be able to.
And we sit for 2 years.
Yeah. Stymie the president's agenda. And then,
I hate to say that, but that's what we're about at this point. Just sit for 2 years and try in 2020.
And it's a really interesting place that we're in where, you know, basically what has transpired politically over the last couple months, Kavanaugh, what's going on now, the Democrats are in great shape, House district by House district, but the Senate contests have just, you know, moved more Republican. But it's the dynamic of very conservative states that are up, few states that are Democrats are defending more territory versus the Republicans.
So we'll end on this. Did you see Newt's comments last night?
No, I missed those.
Newt Gingrich.
What did he say?
And I'll find this and text this to you. I don't know where he was speaking, but asked a question about Trump's tax returns. And if the Dems won the House, could they force Trump to give up his tax returns? Newt said, if they try that, we will take that to the Supreme Court. And I'm quoting him now. And then we'll find out if that Kavanaugh fight was worth it.
Whoa.
The audience gasped when he said it. And this was a Newt-friendly conservative. I'll have to send you this to where it was.
Okay, yeah.
It was shocking that Newt Gingrich would say that. We'll find out if that Kavanaugh fight was worth it.
Well, there's no doubt there in terms of what he was saying.
I think that's pretty clear.
Stark, yeah.
As in, we nominated Kavanaugh and went through that for specific protections of stuff
loyalty
like this.
To the president, yeah.
Absolutely. It's got to be a better week next week.
Oh, I hope so.
It's got to be. All right, I'll see you later, Brandon.
See ya, Craig.